I'm reading a book on the psychology of now, how the mind creates its sense of what's going on in the present moment. And as the author points out, as she goes from one revelation to the next, we don't just pick up stimuli from outside, put them together, see what we've got. We anticipate, we have perceptions. Otherwise, our response to the outside world would be too slow. So we have to anticipate from what we've seen. Of course, that depends on our experience in the past. And our experience in the past is not just a metal or a series of metal constructions. The way our body felt at those times is also important, part of that sense of that time. We're not just with bits of information and body sensations, but there are emotions as well. And the emotions interact with the body. The states of the body affect your emotions. Your emotions affect the state of your body. And on top of that, we regulate our perceptions by acting, doing something. Perceptions that don't work, we throw away. Perceptions that do work, we keep. As I've been reading the book, I keep thinking, the Buddha saw all this 2,600 years ago. This is all nothing new. What may be mind-bending for someone who has a very intellectual idea of how we interact with the present, for the Buddha, was what he had seen looking inside. And he's amazing in the sense that he was able to pinpoint exactly where the big issues were. Like when he talks about the three kinds of fabrication. The way you breathe is the connection between your mind and your body. So he has you focus on the breath. He has you focus on how you talk to yourself about the breath, because how you talk to yourself is how you construct the reality as in all situations. Of course, those constructions are going to be built out of perceptions. Sometimes the sentences form the larger context and we stick our perceptions in them. And sometimes the perceptions will change, so we have to change the larger picture. It's all happening right here as we focus on the breath. Then our sense of cause and effect. Where does that come from? Well, it comes from the fact that the mind is a cause. You have an intention. Now, the intention may have been sparked by something coming in from outside. But then you act on that intention. As he taught Rahula, be very careful about which intentions you act on. And then look very carefully at the results of your actions, why you're doing them, and when they're done. Learn from that. Commit, as the Buddha would say, and then reflect. If we didn't act on the world, we wouldn't know what is connected with what, which is a cause, which is an effect. It would just be a show, a parade coming by. But as we get a sense through our actions pushing against the world, we see where it pushes back and see where it allows us to push. This is why it's so important that as you meditate that you realize you are doing something. This is a type of karma. We're not here just to be the witness. There will be a stage in the practice where you practice that for a certain purpose. But in the beginning, it's very much a doing. You want to get more and more sensitive to how you shape things and what you learn from how you shape things. It's like learning a language. They say one of the best ways of learning a language is not simply to think of what you want to say and then look it up. First, think of what you want to say and then ask yourself, well, how would I say that based on the knowledge I already have in the language? You try to learn how to think in the language. And then you test it against what the proper way of saying it would be. And you see where you were wrong. And you don't get upset because you were wrong. You just realize that your structure, how you put that language together, is not quite right yet. So you learn. And you're happy to learn. What this means in meditation is you try things out. Think of the Buddha and his quest for awakening. He tried things out. And he didn't just dabble. If there was a course of action he thought was worthwhile, seemed likely, he would follow it with all his conviction and persistence and mindfulness and concentration and discernment. In other words, putting his strength into the practice. And then when he got results, convinced that these were the best results you could get from that practice, then he would judge it. A couple of times when he judged it as inadequate was when he was studying with the two teachers who taught formless jhanas. Then he went off on his own. He tried austerities. In that case, he realized he'd reached the point where if he continued with the austerities, he would die. That was obviously not the path. But he tried things out. He acted on his assumptions. And when the results were not what he wanted, then he went back and examined his assumptions. In the case of the austerities, the assumption was deny yourself as much pleasure as possible. He realized that was going to kill him. Was there an innocent pleasure? And he realized, yes. He remembered the time when he got into the first jhana, when he was sitting under a tree as a child, and then spontaneously his mind settled down. Could that be the path? Something inside said yes, and then he gave it a try. So we're doing, making assumptions, acting on our assumptions, seeing if they work, and doing our sincere best to test them. That's our guarantee. Someone says, don't believe anything until you test it yourself. Well, you have to test yourself in the course of testing things like this. Are you really sincere? Are you really giving your best? That's when you can say you've arrived at a fair judgment. Otherwise, you're like that person who's writing the New York Times. The columnist said he'd tried mindfulness for a couple months, didn't work. Been there, done that. Hadn't even been there. He was in no position to pass judgment. So it's through trial and error. And then reflecting on where your error might be, that you finally reach trial and success. So we're very much engaged in the doing. Without the doing, we'd have no way of testing our perceptions. It'd just be a parade. We'd be the idle witness, watching this parade of things going by. If we didn't ask any questions, if we didn't have any assumptions, if we didn't have any way of testing assumptions, we wouldn't learn anything. So watch out for the type of meditation that says you just want to be an observer. Try bare awareness. From the Buddhist point of view, bare awareness or bare attention doesn't really exist. For him, there are only two kinds of attention, appropriate and inappropriate. Appropriate attention frames things in terms of the Four Noble Truths. Inappropriate attention frames things in other ways. Or maybe it doesn't even have a frame. That would be what bare attention would be. But look at where attention is in the lineup of dependent core arising. There are factors before it that shape it. So by the time you get to attention, it's not bare. It's already been shaped by fabrications, acts of consciousness, perceptions, intentions. And the consciousness of a witness is not pure, as the Buddha pointed out. You can peel away your attachment to the different elements or properties, earth, water, wind, fire, space, arrive at pure consciousness. Pure consciousness can observe feelings from the outside, seeing what's causing a particular feeling, how that feeling comes, how it goes away. But that's still a constructed process, that pure consciousness. You have to realize that's something you do as well. At some point, you have to take that apart. As he says, when you get that consciousness really equanimous, you can apply that equanimity to higher and higher formless states. It would last a long time, but it would still be constructed. You have to ask yourself, is it worth it? If it all falls apart, Is there something that doesn't fall apart? Now, these are questions you ask when the mind gets into good, solid concentration and everything seems really quiet, very still, very pure. Is it really unconditioned? This is where your sincerity and your honesty have to come in. At that point, sometimes the mind is disinclined to do anything further. This is why the Buddha said the secret to his awakening was that he was heedful, ardent, and resolute. He looked at things from all sides to see if there's any danger, any weakness in what he found. He sincerely wanted to do his best. And if more work was required, well, he's resolute in doing it. So this practice we have, trying things out, trying to figure things out, and then taking what we figured out and putting it to the test. That's how the Buddha gained his awakening. That's how awakening is found. Other lazier ways of approaching it just don't work. So take advantage of the faculties you have, your ability to construct perceptions, make assumptions, and then test them. May seem like hit or miss to begin with, but if you are really observant, you begin to hit on target. The important thing is you not get discouraged in the meantime. John Fung used to say his students fell into two types, those who thought too much and those who didn't think enough. The ones he was concerned about were those who thought too much because they would find it difficult to get the mind to settle down. In cases like that, you have to keep encouraging them, he said. Do the teacher's not around to encourage you? Well, learn to encourage yourself. You've got these tangled vines in your awareness, these tangled vines in your mind. If you get discouraged by them now, they're just going to stay there. And when the time comes to die, you'll find yourself entangled. Clear these things out while you can. And how do you do it? Arriving at perceptions, arriving at assumptions, putting them to the test. And clear things out. This is why meditation is an active process and not a passive one. You're the doer and the witness, not just the witness. You commit and you reflect, and then you commit again and reflect again. That, the Buddha said, is how the Dharma is nourished.